Hi, everybody. Welcome back for episode 3 in our third season of the American Song Podcast. Everybody knows the analogy of how a tree grows in a forest. In this podcast, we've seen how the music that was brought over from Africa has become the trunk, the sturdy backbone for popular music. Every so often, as major branches grow, some of them in turn sprout their own smaller branches and so on. As far as this analogy goes, we're now midway up that tree. If you were climbing, you could look back down and see how the blues gave rise to jazz, and then gospel, and then R&B, and you'd be able to follow the growth of the gospel branch up into the air where it divided and how soul grew out of that. Likewise, you could follow where New Orleans jazz gave way to swing and bebop and hard bop and third string, jazz fusion, and so on. Up in the canopy of our tree, where the branches start twisting around each other, you'd see how blues and R&B influenced the birth of rock. And you'd notice how rock likewise changed the direction that jazz was growing in. And that's where jazz fusion and jazz rock started growing. We can learn something else from looking at trees. The environment they grow in decides the kind of fruit they're going to produce. Maple trees grow in colder climates, and in the right conditions, we get maple syrup. Orange trees like lots of sunlight in warmer conditions. And it's like that with music, too. Nature teaches us more, though. Flowers need bees to thrive. And all through the musical journey of ours, we've seen how artists, great thinkers, authors, and musicians have influenced each other. Like bees carrying pollen from fruit blossom to fruit blossom. We've seen how artists like Aretha Franklin, who grew up in the black church, first became a gospel singer, but using today's language, she became woke to the conditions around her and her music became a rallying point for the civil rights movement. Today, we're going further up the tree, into the funk. Funk grew in the shade of jazz, soul, R&B, gospel, and rock. In time, it's going to give rise to other branches, for instance, disco and hip-hop. It'll influence branches that have been growing for a while already, like rock and jazz, even classical music, believe it or not. Funk is growing in some difficult environments, like urban ghettos. It's impacted by some heavy weather, like the civil rights movement and the war in Vietnam. There's been a ton of cross-fertilization along the way. Funk is going to become another important branch in our tree. Funk has a direct lineage out of the blues and plantation communities, jazz, Pentecostal gospel music, soul, and R&B. In a lot of ways, funk is a proud, positive retelling of the African-American social story. Heavy with improvisation and syncopation, just like its musical grandparents are. Like the blues, jazz, R&B, and soul, funk's driving rhythms were the hard-pan roadways that carried its soulful vocals. Likewise, funk sprang out of rock and roll, which also grew out of the blues and soul. Funk and rock are first cousins in music's family tree. And like soul, funk is steeped in emotion and feeling. Funk reaches back historically to the plantation work songs and spirit hollers. It invokes the call and response that had held those early black American communities together. Like the soul musicians of the 1960s, funk's artists were banner carriers for the civil rights movement. Starting in the 60s, soul music came right out of the black church. The great soul musicians like Al Green, Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles, and Sam Cooke started their musical lives leading black church communities in praise. The civil rights movement was the natural extension of that kind of vocation. Their music reflected the struggle for equality and justice. 7 or 8 years into the 60s, and the struggle for social justice had built in intensity from the peaceful Martin Luther King Jr. marches to the militants of the Black Panthers. Here's Malcolm X to talk about that.
We are oppressed. We are exploited. We are downtrodden. We are denied not only civil rights, but even human rights. So the only way we're going to get some of this oppression and exploitation away from us or aside from us is come together against a common enemy. Who taught you to hate the texture of your hair? Who taught you to hate the color of your skin to such extent that you bleach to get like the white man? Who taught you to hate the shape of your nose and the shape of your lips? Who taught you to hate yourself from the top of your head to the soles of your feet? Who taught you to hate your own kind? Who taught you to hate the race that you belong to? So much so that you don't want to be around each other. No, before you come asking Mr. Muhammad, does he teach hate? You should ask yourself, who taught you to hate being what God gave you? And I, for one, as a Muslim, believe that the white man is intelligent enough. If he were made to realize how black people really feel and how fed up we are without that old compromising sweet talk. Stop sweet talking it. Tell him how you feel. Tell him how, what kind of hell you've been catching, and let him know that if he's not ready to clean his house up, if he's not ready to clean his house up, he shouldn't have a house. It should catch on fire and burn down. This was the context that funk music leaped out of with all of the intensity of a full-force gale. A more forceful sound was required for the times, and the musicians reached back into their heritage and gift for jazz improv. The bugle call of tight horn sections, and the thumping syncopation of heavy bass and drums. The lights are out. The stage is set. Shine a spotlight on the solitary figure of one James Brown, singer, songwriter, bandleader, the godfather of soul. Brown's personal story is similar to the hardship that millions of black Americans experienced, giving rise to the civil rights movement. He grew up in poverty in a South Carolina sharecropping family. His mother, Susie Brown, left his father, Joe, when James was little, and Joe took the family to Augusta, Georgia to live with his sister, who ran the brothel that James grew up in. He witnessed a lot of things in his home that little kids shouldn't be exposed to. You can use your imagination on this one. His family needed the money, so James dropped out of school in the 7th grade and started working odd jobs. One of them was singing in a gospel group that performed in local churches. By the time he was in his teens, he was stealing cars, and this landed him in a juvenile detention center for 4 years. During this time there, he and a friend named Johnny Terry formed a gospel group. After his time in detention, he made his way to Toccoa, Georgia, and joined a band called the Famous Flames. There were a bunch of early hits, including Try Me, Bewildered, Think, I Don't Mind,
I'll Go Crazy, and this one, Please, Please, Please.
Please, 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 please.
Sound was a combination of the Flames' smooth backing harmonies and Brown's fiery, impassioned singing. Their live act featured their synchronized dance. The famous Flames charted numerous times on both the R&B and the Top 40 pop charts. By 1960, the groove had become the James Brown Revue. Their brand of soul music was slowly morphing into actual funk. Although fully formed funk was still a few years away, and Brown was burning up the charts with singles like Papa's Got a Brand New Bag, I Got You, It's a Man's 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 World, Cold Sweat, and Funky Drummer. His vocal style came right out of the black church, punching holes in the radio airwaves with his groans, grunts, wails, screams, cries of, "Good God! Blow your horn and take it to the bridge." Those became hallmarks of his sound, not to mention hooks, that even other bands started to use in their own compositions, like Led Zeppelin's The Crunge.
Show is a good friend. I bridge. Ice in the bridge.
Where's that confounded bridge?
Known as the hardest working man in showbiz, Brown seduced global audiences with his signature moves, howling wails, and powerful sexuality. He's nothing less than one of the greatest musicians of the 20th century, and we think of him today like that for a number of reasons. First off, he sang in a completely unique style that, just like his band, lit a torch under other musicians that followed in his path. You can hear James Brown and Mick Jagger, David Bowie, CeeLo Green. Even Beyoncé lists James Brown as a major influence on her music and stage presence. Besides his unique vocals, Brown's experimental, restless nature led him into some new territories that was also followed by others after him. In this song, he took emphasized rhythm over chord changes and melody, saying that melody was, quote, old-fashioned and out of step.
What you were doing, brother, stay ahead of me. But when I get punched, I do the same. And when I want loving.
Second, he was a consummate showman. James Brown in concert was a mesmerizing, electrifying event. He positively drove his fans wild with his seething energy and charisma. With dance moves like nobody else had, James burned up stages everywhere doing the James Brown shuffle and the mashed potato. He put it all out there for his audience to the point that he'd routinely collapse on stage, needing to be carried off by his bandmates. And while this was true, his band members often felt limited and how they were allowed to interact with the audiences during Brown's live sets. Here's James Brown to discuss why he demanded such control on stage.
Well, I taught him organization. They didn't have organization. And discipline is very important. You wouldn't take, you know, I wanted them where they could play at West Point as well as play in the street, on the corner. I mean, West Point, or Navy Academy place. I wanted them to be able to go anywhere. And see, when I went to play Popper's Bag and stuff like that, I could play for the president, and I could go and play for the people in the street. That's what you call being totally accepted and being totally straight about what you felt. I'll do it now, but, you know, the musicians now, they have a lot more respect, and they're more intense on doing right. Oh, a lot of major things, I did a total program, like a West Point. They got to be clean, neat, the shirt got to be pressed, shoes got to be shine, the suit got to be pressed, they got to play correct. They can't be looking off when they should be watching me, because then they miss something, I find them.
The man paved a path that many other musicians followed. George Clinton, Michael Jackson, Prince, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and many more. Brown fused soul, funk, and R&B in such a way that he created a whole new genre. He's the godfather of funk. Here's Mick Jagger talking about his admiration of James Brown.
Well, James Brown, you know, what to me, well, I was, I sort of put it in the past, but I mean, I am a big fan of James Brown and I still listen to James Brown, even though I've spent about 18 months on it. I mean, I was a huge fan when I first, well, first of all, we had this record of the James Brown Live at the Apollo. That was I'd heard other things first, but that was the one that sort of kicked it off, and everybody had that. It was a huge number one record in there, but it was very popular. In England, and you know, me and all my friends, we played it to death. So I knew what I'm coming to is, you knew the stage show. That was the stage show. you know what I'm saying? So you knew the station. So when I went to see him first in 1964, he was basically still doing that show, but you knew it already so well. And it was amazing to see, because you'd imagined it in your mind how it was going to be. And there it was. And it was just great. And so I had never seen him on stage. And you know, he's an electrifying stage performer. And I'd worked with Little Richard, which is obviously part of this story, which I didn't really know at the time. So, because Little Richard come from the same place. And I'd worked with Little Richard, I'd done a long tour with Little Richard, and Little Richard had taught me an incredible amount of things. And he was very generous with his, you know, comments and notes and, you know, what you have to do with an audience. And he was like James Brown. They were both similar in the fact that they really communicated with an audience. A lot of people in this time, you know, didn't really know how to communicate with audiences. He was a kind of like good guy to be thinking, well, this is a good sort of role model for your stage performing. I don't just mean in the moves, but yeah, the moves are great, but the energy levels and the way that he did the dynamics, you know, of the show, because it's not all up, you know, you see little clips, it's all kind of him going nuts, but it wasn't really like that. It was a lot of dynamics, slow numbers, slow ballads, slow it down, get you know, the audience going crazy even doing a slow number. Then, you know, he was kind of an inspiration to me.
James was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1986. He received a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award in 1992, and in 2004, Rolling Stone magazine ranked him as the 7th greatest artist of all time. Not too bad for the little boy who grew up in a brothel. Since funk came right out of the same steamy, hot southern soil that blues and jazz did, it was natural that it also carried a lot of the original attitudes and energy. So a band like the Meters had to happen. After all, they came out of New Orleans, the original home of jazz. In the world of funk, the Meters are the lost tribe, more of a reputation or even mythology than an actual band. They only made the charts a few times in the 1960s, but they influenced everyone else we'll talk about in today's episode. James Brown dipped heavily into their grooves. George Clinton wrote their praises in his autobiography. And Maurice White from Earth, Wind & Fire had this to say about the Meters.
I first heard the Meters in the early 70s, and I was really impressed with their rhythm approach, which was different than most people. They had a big sound. Out of four guys.
The Meters defined New Orleans funk. Their original 1965 lineup included keyboardist and vocalists Art and Cyril Neville, the guitarist Leo Nocentelli, George Porter Jr. on bass, and Joseph Zigaboo Modaliste on drums. The music of the Meters is ground zero for down-home, earthy funk instrumentals with an emphasis on organic, complex rhythms. Like I mentioned earlier, here's the jazz syncopation that came kicking and thumping back into the music with funk. It's the layered percussion, all pulsing, writhing, and interwoven like a nest of voodoo rattlesnakes, shaking out gritty grooves on guitar and organ, creating a sound that earned them a small but totally devoted cult during the 1970s. They grew out of informal jam sessions that were held late at night in local New Orleans nightclubs. Around that time, Alan Toussaint and Marshall Seahorn hired them to be the house band for their label, Sansu Enterprises. The Meters have been nominated 4 times now for membership in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I'm sure there's going to be a time that'll eventually come around. Meanwhile, they've won the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. The band charted just only 7 times during the course of their career, starting in 1969, but several other songs, including Look a Pie Pie, Sissy Strut, Ease Back, Hand Clapping Song, and Be My Lady, have become hallmarks in funk. Besides recording their own music, by the early 1970s, the Meters were the most in-demand studio band for a lot of really famous musicians, including Robert Palmer, Dr. John, Little Feat, Alan Toussaint, the Neville Brothers, Jack Johnson, Paul McCartney, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and Robbie Robinson. The Meters were an otherworldly great live band. I mean, just listen to how tight this band is. They sound like one man. In fact, when McCartney released his album Venus and Mars in 75, he hired the Meters to play the album release party on board the Queen Mary. Mick Jagger was on board, and blown away, he hired them to join the Stones on their 75 and 76 tours. Here's the Meters' George Porter remembering that tour.
There was a tour that got put together to go to Europe, but it was Dr. John, Professor Longhair, Snooks Eaglin was supposed to go, and he backed out at the airport, and the Meters. And the Meters was going to be the house band behind everybody except Professor Longhair. That was our first introduction to Europe, and Europe's first sighting of the Meters. And it was like, we opened the show, we played our gig, and the response was like, well, overwhelming. And then we brought all the other artists and stuff. At the end of the evening, there was a meet and greet for the Meters only. No one else was invited to the meet and greet. And at that point, we met the whole entire European royalty, musical royalty, from the Beatles, the Stones, at that time, it was Faces. Cyril Neville eventually joined the Meters, and that happened because of a Rolling Stones tour that we did in 75. It was brought to us by, at the time, a tour manager named Rupert Sirkoff, who had him and Marshall had been powwowed, and, you know, I can't tell you exactly what it was, but the end result was that we needed a front singer to compete with the Rolling Stones. We just couldn't go and be the four of us like we've been living most of our lives already. Rupert had the ear of Art, and far as Art was concerned, he had been trying to move his brothers into this band from probably the second year that we were together. He wanted a Neville Brother band, but he really wanted the Meters to be that Neville Brother band. That was a dream, you know. And I can understand that. I can dig it. You know, the problem that we, the three of us had, was that if that was to happen, then we would no longer be the Meters. You know, we would end up being what the Neville Brothers turned into, you know, the Neville Brothers band. So that band, we bought that idea, but doing that, and doing 75, having Cyril come in as a cuda player, and he was, at the time, he wasn't even a cuda player, he wasn't a percussionist. They just, you know, he didn't want to be out there by himself without doing something, you know. So, I mean, so they settled with them playing cudas, you know, and he played at the cudas, but he did mostly with Rupert and them wanted him to do, be the front man.
Later on, both Keith Richards and Ron Wood followed that up, hiring the Meters to also accompany them on their individual solo tours. Even though the Meters never broke into the mainstream, they still had a powerful impact. If imitation is the highest form of compliment, then their heads must be pretty big by now. Their music had been sampled by a who's list of rap artists such as Heavy D, LL Cool J, and Queen Latifah, Run DMC, NWA, Ice Cube, Cypress Hill, Public Enemy, A Tribe Called Quest, The Beastie Boys, and Naughty by Nature have all cited the Meters as important influences. Here's the Meters guitarist Leo Nocentelli talking about the band's influence on today's rap.
The most flattering thing, I think, from a personal level and financial aspect, is the fact that all of the young rappers, man, has took the Meters music and sampled. They're sampling music that was done 30 years ago.
Other bands have recorded their songs. For instance, here's Red Hot Chili Peppers on the Meters song Africa from the Red Hot Chili Peppers album Freaky Styly. They retitled the song Hollywood. The eclectic jazz fusion guitarist Oz Noy has recorded his own version of Sissy Strut twice. The bass player Les Claypool's band Primus covered the Meters song Tippy Toes on their EP called Miscellaneous Debris. At one time or another, bands further removed from funk, including the Grateful Dead, Widespread Panic, and the great jazz bassist Jaco Pastorius, have all included Meters songs in their shows. If that's what it means to be unknown, I guess we can all hope for good things in the future. In the 1970s, funk's development echoed the social and political issues happening in the world around it. The heat in the civil rights movement continued at fever levels. The U.S. government continued to sacrifice America's youth in a war that military intelligence, ever an oxymoron, declared non-winnable. And as long as it was hiding that terrible fact, the Nixon administration thought it would go all in on cover-ups when it decided to lie about the DNC break-in at the Watergate Hotel. Let's listen to Tricky Dick for a second for a great reminder of the beautiful 1970s.
In all the decisions I have made in my public life, I have always tried to do what was best for the nation. Throughout the long and difficult period of Watergate, I have felt it was my duty to persevere, to make every possible effort to complete the term of office to which you elected me. In the past few days, however, it has become evident to me that I no longer have a strong enough political base in the Congress to justify continuing that effort. As long as there was such a base, I felt strongly that it was necessary to see the constitutional process through to its conclusion, that to do otherwise would be unfaithful to the spirit of that deliberately difficult process, and a dangerously destabilizing precedent for the future. But with the disappearance of that base, I now believe that the constitutional purpose has been served, and there is no longer a need for the process to be prolonged. I would have preferred to carry through to the finish, whatever the personal agony it would have involved. And my family unanimously urged me to do so. But the interests of the nation must always come before any personal considerations. From the discussions I have had with congressional and other leaders, I have concluded that because of the Watergate matter, I might not have the support of the Congress that I would consider necessary to back the very difficult decisions and carry out the duties of this office in the way the interests of the nation will require. I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my mind.
So these were the red, white, and blue drapes that funk music was trying to tear down in the 1970s. Many funk tracks of the time reflected the struggle for social justice and equality, and they served as a rallying cry for marginalized communities. Even the title of Miles Davis's Bitches Brew album was a protest against the Vietnam War, and its experimental sound was a reflection of that era's counterculture. James Brown's song, I Don't Want Nobody to Give Me Nothing, Open Up the Door, I'll Get It Myself, was a politically charged rant addressing issues of race, poverty, social injustice, and the war in Vietnam. On March 15, 1943, Alpha and K.C. Stewart, two musicians trying to eke out a living in the community of Denton, Texas, became parents of a tiny baby boy for the second time in their lives. Before too long, they left Texas and they moved to the central California town of Vallejo, where they raised that little boy. His name was Sylvester, lovingly nicknamed Sly. Of course, we know him today by the name Sly Stone.
Another child grows up to be somebody you just love to burn.
His parents noticed his early love of music and encouraged him. Daddy taught him to play the guitar, and Mama taught him how to sing. His early influences included gospel, blues, and R&B. He especially loved the music of Ray Charles, James Brown, and Little Richard. Late at night, that little boy would sneak out of the home just to listen to the latest R&B and soul hits on the local radio station. Music was one of the only comforts in a home where both parents were alcoholics and the violence left a lasting impact on them. With Sly's mother being black and his father coming from a mixed Native American-Mexican background, Sly, who already didn't fit into the white community, didn't feel at home anywhere else either. But the young man was a true musical genius, and the one place that really was his own was in music. He started performing in local bands while still a teenager, and this young prodigy quickly caught the attention of the local music scene, starting with a band called the Viscanes, which he formed with his brother Freddie in the mid-1960s. Theirs was an interesting blend of doo-wop, back with R&B. We're listening to their first single now called Yellow Moon. And even though this is a pretty good beginning, it's still missing Sly's innovative, eclectic approach. We don't hear his vision or the way his songs reflected the major issues of the time. Sly, In the Family Stone's funk, carry the heavy syncopation of jazz, the drive of R&B, and the intensity of soul, and in a way that also reflected the electric hippie psychedelia coming out of Haight-Ashbury in the late 60s. Songs like Everyday People, Stand, and this one, Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself Again, celebrated diversity and unity among people. Forget about races and backgrounds. Can't we all just get along? On top of that, songs like I Want to Take You Higher, Dance to the Music, and Life celebrated individuality and self-expression. Being true to yourself, or using a phrase from David Crosby, letting your freak flag fly. Sly also called on his own spiritual experiences to write songs about his faith. Songs like Thank You for Talking to Me, Africa, Heard You Miss Me While I'm Back, and Blessing in Disguise carried his messages of redemption, forgiveness, and the power of belief. Sly also wrote about love and relationships, never shrinking back from some of the messier sides. Songs like If You Want Me to Stay, Family Affair, and Hot Fun in the Summertime captured the excitement and passion of me. Other songs like Running Away and Everybody is a Star spoke to the difficulties of maintaining relationships over time. Sly Stone's unique blend of rock, soul, funk, and jazz profoundly impacted a wide range of musicians across multiple genres. For instance, Michael Jackson's Don't Stop Till You Get Enough is a direct descendant of Sly and the Family Stone's funk sound. So is Stevie Wonder's Superstition. George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic were heavily influenced by Sly and the Family Stone, and so was Prince. The Black Eyed Peas, Public Enemy, and The Roots have all cited Sly as one of their biggest influences. In fact, Prince's music included elements of funk, jazz, rock, soul, and R&B, and he talked about how Sly was one of his biggest inspirations. In fact, he said, "Sly and the Family Stone changed my life. They were the first band that I heard that was not just black or white. They were just music, and that's what I wanted to do." At another point, he said, "Sly and the Family Stone were one of the most important bands in music history. They paved the way for so many other artists." Anyway, when I listen to 1999 or this song, Kiss, I hear Sly and the Family Stone all over it. Even as the architect of funk, James Brown's music also owed a lot to Sly's compositions. You'll hear it in the way he adopted his use of horns and drums to more closely follow Sly's innovations in those areas. The funk elements in Brown's song Papa Don't Take No Mess include funk elements that remind me of Sly Stone's music, and the horns on his song Funky President people it's bad, have a very Sly Stone feel to them, too. Now, I've already spoken often in this podcast series about all the ways Miles Davis redefined himself and music in general during his career. But in 1972, Miles once again surprised the world when he released a jazz-funk fusion album called On the Corner. I'm quoting from MilesDavis.com here. Quote, On the Corner is the one Miles album that needed time for its true value to be appreciated. It first met harsh reviews when it was released in 1972. Today, it's praised for planting seeds that are still flowering. John Zwed is an author, anthropologist, and jazz scholar. He's also been professor emeritus at Columbia College in New York and at Yale College. So I think he knows his stuff. Anyway, in a piece he wrote about On the Corner, Zwed said, Davis broke every rule enforced by the jazz boys. Yet today, we hear that Davis was laying the foundations for drum and bass, trip-hop, jungle, and all the other musics of repetition to come. A member of the Miles Davis Protégé Club, and once a keyboardist in Miles' band, Herbie Hancock has also been influenced by Sly Stone's fusion of jazz and funk. Even while Herbie took it to another place, you can hear echoes of Sly through his album Headhunters, which, like On the Corner, is also wildly praised as a classic in the jazz-funk fusion genre. And this brings us to...
song taken from my album, The Jazz Soul of Little Stevie. The name of the song is called Fingertips. Now I want you to clap your hand. Come on. Come on. Yeah. Stomp your feet. Jump up and down. Do anything that you want to do.
Especially his innovative use of technology and his incorporation of soul and political themes. Like Prince, Stevie Wonder has also listed Sly Stone as one of his biggest musical heroes. Two of his best-known compositions, Living for the City and Superstition, cover the same social justice-type themes and use Sly's funk music elements. On May 13, 1950, in the city of Saginaw, Michigan, Lula Mae Hardaway and Calvin Jukins Morris became the parents of Steveland Hardaway Morris. Steveland was a preemie born 6 weeks early, and he was placed in an incubator. In the incubator, he developed retinopathy of prematurity, which caused damage to the blood vessels in his eyes and resulted in blindness. But you know, the brain is an amazing thing. Because he was deprived in one area, his brain rewired itself in other ways. Actually, back in 2017, a study done by the Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary showed that hearing, smell, and touch, as well as thinking functions like memory and language, all develop in ways that they wouldn't normally in sighted people. In Stevie Wonder's case, he showed an early interest in music, and he began playing the piano at a young age. By the time he was 11, he had also learned to play harmonica, drums, and bass. Under the stage name Little Stevie Wonder, he recorded his first album, The Jazz Soul of Little Stevie, in 1962 at the age of 12. Check him out here during this period in the live performance of his song, Fingertips, which featured him playing several instruments, including the harmonica, bongos, and drums. As a child prodigy, his name ranks with Mozart, who started composing at the age of 5, Mendelssohn, who wrote his first symphony at 15, and there's this girl from England named Alma Deutscher. Probably haven't heard of her, but she wrote her first opera at the age of 7. I was happy just to call her in between the lines at 7. How about you? His folks split when he was just 4, and after that, Stevie was raised by his mom. Times were very hard for the family, and you can hear his memories of those difficult years as they come out in songs like Living for the City, Higher Ground, and You Haven't Done Nothing. Lulu May was a songwriter, and she worked as a domestic worker to support her family. She spotted her son's genius early in his life. I mean, I guess, how could you miss it? And encouraged him to follow his muse. And not only that, she also co-wrote a number of his earlier hits, including I Was Made to Love Her, Signed, Sealed, Delivered, Superstition, and Boogie On, Reggae Woman. Coming from the rich musical family that he did, his father was also a musician. And after the divorce, he actually moved to L.A., and he wrote songs for Motown. Here he is to talk about those early days.
So back then, obviously, I didn't write Fingertips, but I did it, and, you know, all the other songs I did, too. And, you know, the difference between then and now, back then, I had this tape bag that I carried around for years of melodies and ideas and all that kind of stuff. I had in that bag, you know, Mashirimor, the idea for Mashirimor, the idea for Hey Love, I had a chance to put the music, you know, to work with Henry Cosby, and Sylvia Moy. It was the melodies and the music idea that I would give them. It was a great marriage, one that really made it possible for me to continue to be at Motown, because I think by the age of 14 and a half, they had this meeting at Motown. They said, you know what, his voice is changing and things are different. We don't know what to do with this kid. I think we're going to have to let him go.
What?
And so...
Wait, is that when you were a little nappy-headed boy?
Well, I... You know, I was a little nappy-headed before that. But yeah, it was in that time. Way before cornrows. And just for the record, the reason I got cornrows is because I was so tired of my mother combing my hair, and it hurt.
Really?
Yeah. That's crazy. And I liked the way it felt. But it was that Sylvia Moy said, you know what, I think I'm going to commit to working with him. If Hank, if you're with it, he's got some melodies and some things we want to kind of like mess with and see what we get. And so they did, and we started doing stuff together. And then it was... all those, you know, little Stevie Wonder to Stevie Wonder, you know, young Stevie Wonder hit songs, you know, from the Nothing's Too Good to for my Baby to I Was Made to Love Her, which is about a girl that I was crazy about named Angie.
Stevie's musical palette includes elements of soul, R&B, pop, and funk. He's widely regarded as a funk pioneer. As a songwriter, Wonder drew inspiration from other funk greats. In various interviews through the years, he's mentioned James Brown, Sly and the Family Stone, George Clinton, Bootsy Collins, Herbie Hancock, and Miles Davis. Besides funk, though, his musical sponge soaked up the sounds and rhythms of many genres, including soul, R&B, and jazz. music so great that it became one of his signature songs with its funky bass line and horn section. So 2 years later, he followed up with the Talking Book album. It cemented his status as a funk innovator. The lead single, Superstition, was a badass heavy bass line, a spiky clavinet riff, and driving drum beat. Heavy on the one. It became the blueprint for funk music in the years to come, and is one of the all-time classic funk recordings. In 1971, Stevie Wonder signed his second contract with Motown, a contract that gave him complete artistic control of his music. This had never been done for any of Motown's artists before. It began what has in later years been recognized as the greatest creative run in the history of popular music. In 5 consecutive years, he released Where I'm Coming From, Music of My Mind, Talking Book, Inner Visions, and Fulfilling This First Finale, as well as Songs in the Key of Life. 3 of these albums won the Grammy for Best Album of the Year. Where I'm Coming From and Talking Book were Wonder's declaration of independence from the Motown Hit Factory production line of tightly controlled cookie-cutter artists. He showed that his composition skills were every bit as good as what Motown's writers could crank out, and his lyrics were deeply personal as well as socially powerful. On the Talking Book album cover, he dressed in African robes and braided hair, showing his strong pride in being a black man. Talking Book featured synthesizers, still experimental at the time, and his collaboration with a team of musicians, producers, and engineers named Malcolm Cecil and Robert Margulies. In his first working long weekend with them, he actually wrote 17 songs. Yeah, you heard that right. 17 songs in 3 days. Those songs on Talking Book are mostly love songs, sophisticated, lovely songs that show every facet, from the euphoria to the heartbreak, jealousy, regret, and anticipation. You Are the Sunshine of My Life and Looking for Another Pure Love are written from such a universal perspective that while they can be heard as songs of romance, they can just as easily stand for family, friends, community, and faith. And just as powerfully, he suddenly lays Superstition on us, a warning shot against gullibility and received opinion. And in Big Brother, he delivers a line like, "I live in the ghetto," and proceeds to tear down the kind of self-righteous, phony politicians who pandered for the black inner city vote, but were tired of me protesting, children dying every day. On Talking Book, Wonder sang in a wiser, more mature voice than he ever had before. He talked, crooned, teased, preached, moaned, barked, and growled. It's not exactly any single genre. It's everything at you at once. Gospel, blues, soul, rock, and jazz. The entire journey of black music and its derivatives since the start of the century. Great music stands outside of time. It never sounds dated. It rises above that. This album does all of that and more. Later albums like Inner Visions, Fulfilling This First Finale, and Songs in the Key of Life were all heavy on funk grooves and danceable rhythms. He also collaborated with other funk pioneers like George Clinton and Bootsy Collins, further cementing his place in the genre. Funk being an activist's genre, and Wonder being the child of the 60s that he is, he's lent his name to many important social causes throughout his career. One of those causes that he successfully championed was the creation of a Martin Luther King Jr. national holiday. Here's Stevie to talk about his effort there.
I never saw it as like being political. I just saw it as being the right thing to do. I just felt that a man who had fought for the economic, social, and civil rights for all people should be recognized for the greatness that he did. And for those like himself who lived and died for that should be recognized. And when people would say to me, hey, a black holiday, I said, no, this is our holiday for everyone. He was a black man, and as I said, he was an African-American man, but I'm not looking at a color of a person's skin. But as Dr. King said, the content of their character. I just really believed that it was time to celebrate Dr. King. And as opposed to being in the spirit of, oh, please, 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 I don't beg for it. You know, this is something that should just happen because, you know, it's for everyone. You know, it's for that farmer who is having a hard time. It's for that black man who is being, you know, there's prejudice against. It's for that Native American who really, you know, hosted the people that came here. Not first, but they came here. You know, it's for, you know, in the spirit of all of the various people that have done great things. Because you see, for me, I've always felt this, and, you know, someone said it later, and it's exactly how I did feel. It's not about, you know, the color of the skin, your ethnicity. And it's not about your religion, it's about your relationship.
He's brought attention to a series of issues he associates closely with everything, from the civil rights movement to disability rights, environmentalism, music education, gun control, humanitarian causes, famine relief, AIDS awareness, and disaster release efforts. In this interview, he spoke his mind on the issues of racism, voter suppression, and the Trump administration.
This past Friday, many of us celebrated Juneteenth. I did. And yet so many others didn't and haven't. As a matter of fact, there are three states that still do not recognize it. North Dakota, South Dakota, and Hawaii. How did it feel to celebrate freedom that we're still fighting for? It felt and feels too familiar. I know that dance. I've heard those songs. It was an 18-year fight to get Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday a national holiday. Yet, it was a fight I was not willing to lose. It was a fight that many of you joined. And I thank you. But here we are again and again and again and again. I'm not one who make believes. I know that leaves are green. They only turn to brown. When autumn comes around, I know just what I say. Today's not yesterday. And all things have an ending. But what I'd like to know is when will the day come that we let hate go? Or do I have to concede that for human beings, it's just impossible? But if life can have an ending, all things can have an ending. Systemic racism can have an ending. Police brutality can have an ending. Economic repression of black and brown people can have an ending. A movement without action is a movement standing still. To those who say they care, move more than your mouth. Move your feet to the polls and use your hands to vote. The future is in your hands. We have the power to vote and we can make a change. The youngest at 18 and the oldest at 110 can make a difference. Make your plan now to vote, because right now, There are forces trying to take your vote away in November.
People are also known by the friends they keep. And in Wonder's case, you can see the admiration the musical community has for him from the people past and present that he's collaborated with, including India Ari, Babyface, Tony Bennett, Beyoncé, Bono, Celine Dion, Ariana Grande, Herbie Hancock, Whitney Houston, Julio Iglesias, Michael Jackson, Wyclef Jean, Elton John, Gladys Knight, Paul McCartney, Diane Shore, Barbra Streisand, and even Luciano Pavarotti. George Clinton is the man who put the P into funk. Called a genius and a pioneer of funk music, Clinton created P-Funk, one of the most influential funk subgenres. It blends soul, freeform funk, psychedelic rock, and Afrofuturism, a lyrical mythology with a set of recurring characters set in science fiction and political and social statements. It's found in the music, album liner notes, album artwork, and stage costumes, even in the ads and stage banter. When I was a kid, my friend's father told me something that Clinton seems to have known too. Wally told me, if you want to soar with eagles, you can't hang out with turkeys. George Clinton put that lesson into action by hooking up with musical wizards like Bernie Worrell, Eddie Hazel, and Bootsy Collins, just to name a few. An almost unbelievable number of great musicians, over 170 in fact, have played in Funkadelic and its alter ego band Parliament, not to mention the 20 or so bands that have spun off from the core. Over the course of the mashup that's come to be known as P-Funk, an aggressive psychedelic funky brew of a sound has also come to represent an entire lifestyle, a worldview. On P-Funk's crowded stages and amid its riotous audiences, a single message has been consistent. Everyone is welcome, and there's always room for more. Clinton, who turned 80 recently, started his own musical journey as a choir member at Mount Zion Baptist Church in Kannapolis, North Carolina. Along with his father Cameron, who played guitar, and his mother Gertrude, who sang and played piano. About that experience, Clinton has said, quote, it was a very important part of my life. It taught me a lot about music and about life. You know, I think it's really interesting to see how the Black Church has been such a critical training ground for so many important musicians. Go back and listen to the episode on gospel from May 2021 to dig into that some more. A bit later, Clinton's family relocated north during the Great Migration. They settled in Plainfield, New Jersey. This is where he first made his secular music presence known, starting in the 1950s. He formed a doo-wop band with some friends from his neighborhood, and he called it the Parliaments. They were what you'd expect a doo-wop group of the 50s would be. Tight harmonies, fancy matching suits, and carefully synchronized dance steps. By the early 60s, he'd made his way to Detroit to audition for Motown. Motown saw promise in young Clinton, but not so much in his band, so they passed on the Parliaments, but they hired Clinton as a songwriter, producer, and arranger. Another Detroit label called Revelot did sign the Parliaments, and by 1967, they had their first hit, I Just Want to Testify. But doo-wop soon felt pretty square in the late 1960s, and with other Black artists like Jimi Hendrix busting loose, Clinton saw a new way forward. He imagined a heavy rock sound that still was a blend of soul and gospel and had a heavy, sludgy beat. It was time to rebrand his group and follow his instincts. Funkadelic was the result.
Well, all right. Starcha, citizens of the universe, recording angels. We have returned to claim the pyramid. Partying on the mothership. I am the mothership connection. Get down in 3D. light year grooving. Well, all right. You hear any noise? There ain't nobody but me and the boy. Get down. Hit it, fellas.
And it was time for a new stage act. Creativity is combining two totally unrelated things and seeing something brand new that no one else has ever seen before. One day, while watching cartoons on TV, Clinton realized that he had one of those breakthrough moments. People get them, but cartoons never do. A good character can live forever. In the middle of other bands that were creating a sensation in wholly different ways, bands like The Stooges and MC5, Funkadelic's band members started performing in costumes. Diapers, spacesuits, martial arts uniforms, wizards' robes. In the band's own mythology, Clinton became an astral traveler leading a troop of cosmic black adventurers across the galaxies and pumping out appropriately trippy music like this song, Mothership Connection. Their concerts even featured a huge P-Funk mothership up on the stage. The message to his audience? You can be whatever you choose to be. Don't let the present limitations of your urban lives cage you. You can even be astronauts. Like us. Chemically fueled by acid, Funkadelic released their first album called Free Your Mind and Your Ass Will Follow. Funkadelic wanted their audience to follow their heavy bass-driven grooves to a higher state of consciousness. They built whole songs around Bootsy Collins' squiggling, sensual, thumping bass lines. From a social perspective, Clinton and P-Funk were all about staging the biggest badass party on every stage, every night. It was a celebration of the urban black experience. They made their point clear with songs like this one, One Nation Under a Grievance, with a message that rallied for togetherness in the black community. One Nation Under a Groove, getting down just for the funk of it. Their songs directly confronted the big issues. Politics, poverty, racism, and police brutality. While putting out great albums, P-Funk was a band that you had to see live to really get the full impact of what they were about. Synonymous with high-octane funk, P-Funk made their reputation through consistently unbelievable energy and intense performances where the band left it all on the stage every night.
CC. They still call it the White House, but that's a temporary condition too. Can you dig it, CC? To each his reach, and if I don't cop, it ain't mine to have. But I'll be reaching for you, cause I love you, CC. Right on. There's a lot of chocolate cities around. We've got Newark, we've got Gary. Somebody told me we got LA. And we're working on Atlanta. You're the capital.
Get it on ya.
Get down.
Get it on ya.
Moving in on ya.
Get it on ya.
A night at a P-Funk concert was a high adrenaline rush, right out of Earth Oil, where audiences were lost with the explosive thrust of pounding funk. The band members played off each other's energy and fed off the crowd's enthusiasm. Shows were long and intense. Their outrageous costumes and their onstage antics were a direct rejection of anything mainstream. P-Funk reveled in individuality and self-expression. The mothership prop that they toured with throughout the 70s is now a permanent part of the collection at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. This is a major nod of the hip to what might be Clinton's most important talent. In his own funky way, Clinton was lifting the black community up, continuing to free them from oppression. The spaceship was his vehicle of liberation and freedom, carrying the band from city to city to celebrate black pride and empowerment. This song, Chocolate City, is an awesome example where P-Funk celebrated black culture heroes like Muhammad Ali and Richard Pryor and Aretha Franklin. They underscored the message with the line, "We're the Chocolate City and we're doing it right." Along with James Brown, George Clinton's been called one of the most important figures in the history of popular music. Not bad for a guy that never learned to play any instruments. And here's a short review of his achievements.
Just funny, man.
Soul Train Music Award for Best R&B Funk Album, 1978. Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Induction, 1997. Grammy Award for Best Rhythm and Blues Song, 1998. The NAACP Image Award for Outstanding Song, 1998. BET Lifetime Achievement Award, 2005. ASCAP Rhythm and Soul Music Awards Pioneer Award, 2005. The BMI Icon Award, 2007. The North Carolina Music Hall of Fame, 2009. Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award, 2019. George is 83 years old now. And earlier this year, he announced his retirement. He spent the last incredible 53 years creating one of the most influential funk bands of all time. Today's Parliament Funkadelic is a direct descendant of the original band, with 10 of the band's 16 current members having played with all or at least some P-Funk members from the past.
Yo, stuff. Can't get enough. Be more fun. And we funky too. Right on, Chocolate City. Yeah, get deep. Real deep.
They released their last album in 2018, calling it Medicaid Fraud Dog. Praised by critics for its innovative sound and political commentary, it was their first album in 38 years. The album freely sampled from a wide and varied collection of sources, classic funk songs, hip-hop songs, and even speeches by the Dr. Martin Luther King. The kind of thing that only someone like George Clinton, with his 83 years of road wear, could do convincingly. History? He lived it. He made it. As for political commentary, true to his roots, Clinton tackled a whole series of issues, from racism to sexism to poverty. Most importantly, and most true to form, Medicaid Fraud Dog was about empowerment and hope, just like it's always been for Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic. Well, ladies and gents, that's about all we've got time for in this episode of American Song. I hope you've enjoyed this time-tripping journey through the annals of funk with me this month. We've seen how another generation of great American artists took control of the music to unify people and help us celebrate what's always been and remains as our nation's greatest asset, the ability to rise out of obscurity despite the social, economic, and even physical challenges to create great ideas, amazing sounds, and wonderful art. This episode could have been twice as long. I feel like I've only just scratched the surface. There's so many bands I know I'm leaving out, like Earth, Wind & Fire, Tower of Power, and the Gap Band. All of those come to mind right away. I'm your host, Joe Hines, and I thank you for listening. I'll look forward to visiting with you again next month. Oh, and by the way, if you haven't done it yet, I hope that you'll visit the American Song page on Facebook. Just look for American Song Podcast. Okay, everybody, I'll talk to you soon. Stay funky. Futuristic power.